Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bonjour à toutes et à tous et merci d'être là. Et désolé de briser le monolinguisme de l'autre, je m'adresserai à quelques phrases en français. D'abord pour vous remercier toutes et tous, vous donner également la règle du jeu. Nous allons entendre les deux premières communications, puis nous les discuterons et après une pause, nous referons la même chose. Martin Sarr est professeur de philosophie sociale à l'université Goethe de Francfort sur le Main depuis 2017, après avoir étudié et enseigné à Berlin, à Leipzig, où il fut professeur de théorie politique, et à la Goethe de Francfort. Il a notamment travaillé sur Spinoza, sur Nietzsche, sur Marx, Foucault, au regard de la philosophie sociale et politique contemporaine, notamment lorsqu'elle est saisie par le tournant ontologique. Son dernier livre a été publié en 2025 chez Suhrkamp, Vaciste Social Philosophie, éditeur chez qui il avait également publié en 2013 Die Immanenz der Macht sur Spinoza. Ses recherches actuelles porte sur la relation entre la démocratie et le pouvoir social et politique, la démocratie et les affects, la démocratie et la vie. Et nous sommes très heureux de l'entendre ce matin pour sa conférence Foucault and Critical Theory, Limits, Conditions and Liberations.
Je te remercie, Ben Didier, de m'avoir invité, ainsi que toute l'équipe du Collège de France pour son accueil. C'est pour moi un très grand honneur de m'exprimer en ce lieu si chargé de sens pour toutes nous. Mais c'est aussi à bien des égards une exigence redoutable. Moi, j'ai découvert l'œuvre de Michel Foucault à l'âge de 20 ans, en 1991 à Heidelberg, où je travaillais à l'hôpital universitaire dans le cadre de mon service civil. Depuis lors, je n'ai jamais cessé de le lire. Merci. Alors, en anglais. My title is, or was, Limits, Conditions and Liberations, Foucault and Critical Theory. But rereading this last night, I would say my title is Conditions. Condition. It would be presumptuous, it would be silly to offer you here in Paris a reading of the work and of the legacy of Michel Foucault. His oeuvre has, Didier said it, without any doubt marked the humanities and the social sciences of the last 50 years more than any other individual thinker. We know, or rather you know, Foucault well and well enough that the rest of the world will not tell you or bring you anything new about his work, his intellectual project, or what he had to bring to the table as a philosopher, historian of systems of thought, and an unclassifiable theorist. We, either born too late, like in my case, or living outside Paris, or both, have come to know Foucault through his written and transcribed voice recorded here. This is the literal source, the origin, you might know. You have it. But what we can offer as readers and outsiders are episodes from its impact on other intellectual contexts and sites, elements from its Wirkungsgeschichte, as Gadamer called it. This is literally the histoire de réception, often translated in French as histoire de l'efficience, and in English as the history of effects. And Wirkung, effect, impact, or reception, heavily depends, of course, on context, locality, and specific historical conditions. My first part is called A German Condition. I will try to contribute to this conversation on this level. And one important context for me, at least, at this particular moment of reflecting on Foucault's legacy and continuing relevance, is highly specific and has much to do with a very particular academic culture and, unsurprisingly, with the German context. On March 14th of this year, the German philosopher and sociologist Jürgen Habermas died at the age of 96. Born in 1929, he was a true contemporary of Michel Foucault, And although they certainly did not inhabit the same intellectual and cultural space, they occupied closely interconnected worlds, namely the West European post-war academic milieu and its institutions. Both were strongly influenced by classical German philosophy, from Kant to Hegel to Husserl, as well as by Heidegger and Marxism. Both were fascinating by the new social sciences of their period, anthropology, sociology, and historiography in its most progressive forms, and both were dissatisfied, even disillusioned, with traditional approaches to the central concerns of the humanities. As a result, both became methodological innovators, even iconoclasts. Their lives and careers were deeply shaped in different ways by the cultural caesura that we have come to call 1968 and by the social and political movements associated with the New Left. Both also became, arguably, the most influential philosophers of their respective national cultures, and indeed both became, Didier said it, global intellectuals. For German philosophers of my generation, as well as those preceding and following it, Habermas, who survived Foucault, his contemporary, by more than 40 years, has remained a persistent reference point for followers and critics alike. He also served as a bridge to the academic culture of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, that is, to exactly the space of theoretical debates, conflicts, and intellectual passions that he and Foucault at least partially shared. In general, the German reception of Foucault as a philosopher, theorist, and critical intellectual was shaped to a considerable extent by Habermas's own position within this intellectual field. Even more specifically, Habermas' highly critical reading of Foucault and his polemical attacks on him in the early 1980s, I will talk about this in a second, in the context of the debate on modernity and postmodernity, had a paradoxical effect. On the one hand, they profoundly shaped the German reception of Foucault and to a considerable extent set the terms in which it unfolded. On the other hand, this criticism, most prominently articulated in the book The Philosophical Discourse of Modernity, published a year after Foucault's death, attracted an entire generation of readers to Foucault and prompted them to read him with particular intensity. So it arguably produced a generation of admirers and defenders that might not otherwise have emerged in quite the same way. In this sense, many, certainly not all, German readers of Foucault from the early 1980s onward encountered him in the wake, in the trace of Habermas, or at least within an intellectual space marked by the latter's presence. Second part, Habermas in Paris. This Habermasian inflection of the space within which the German reception of Foucault unfolded is a highly specific feature of that reception. And moreover, it started exactly here, in this very institution, in the Salle B of the Collège de France. Does it still exist? Salle B? No? This was the old nomenclatura before the renovation in the 90s. And on the invitation of Paul Venn, who was a professor there at the time, Habermas delivered in March 1983 a series of four lectures on theories of modernity, a topic that also formed the basis of his lecture courses in Frankfurt during the summer semester of 1983 and the winter semester of 83-84. The book that emerged from these courses appeared in 1985, and as far as we know, Habermas presented drafts corresponding to the first four chapters. Those chapters were not explicitly devoted to Foucault, who was still alive at the time. Nevertheless, he already presented the book's central argument and launched the critical attack on what he characterized as a return of counter-Enlightenment thought. He situated this development within the longer history of post-Enlightenment German philosophy, identifying, as you might know, Nietzsche and to a lesser extent Heidegger as dangerous counter-figures who problematized the achievements of the Enlightenment and called its value into question. Habermas had already offered this characterization of the present situation in his address in September 1930, receiving the Adorno Prize, as well as in other shorter texts on modernity and the advent of the postmodern. This already was a transnational debate connected above all to Geoffroy Lyotard's influential La Condition Postmoderne, but also to developments in American literary theory and to debates in architecture that Habermas followed closely. Many people heard the term postmodern in the context of the debate on contemporary architecture at the time. Discourses proclaiming an end or an exhaustion of modernity, Habermas argued, came dangerously close to denying the intrinsic values of modernity itself, its commitment to social and political equality, and to the autonomy of the individual. In the first four chapters of the book, that is, in what it presented here, the targeted crew, or motley crew, of anti-moderns remains relatively broad, even vague. Yet the extended discussions of Nietzsche already points in a direction that would have been readily understood in Paris, and it was. After all, the Nietzsche français, or rather an entire Nietzschean passion, had captivated several generations of French intellectuals from Bataille, Klossowski, and the Surrealists, leading to major philosophical and scholarly engagements by Blanchot, Deleuze, and many, many others. Moreover, at the time, it was completely obvious to anyone familiar with the contemporary French scene that one of the leading figures of this movement was Michel Foucault himself, who had been lecturing on Nietzsche since the beginning of his career. And by the way, Foucault did not attend the lectures Habermas was giving. So he was attending dinners, but not the lectures. It remains somewhat unclear why, for Habermas at the time, the transition from Hegel to Nietzsche and to Lebensphilosophy, to reactionary forms of Kulturkritik, Heideggerianism, and the recurrence of neo-Nietzscheanism and postmodernity really jeopardizes or even betrays the hopes and ambitions of the Enlightenment project. Concepts that are not identical with modernity, but intimately connected. What is clear, however, is the role assumed by the speaker, by Habermas himself. He appears as the critic and diagnostician of the present, speaking out about the malaise of the present. There is a position from which these dangers and risks can be identified and articulated, and there is another position, occupied presumably by many French authors, among them Foucault. Part three, a debate that never was. This strategy and framework was, as I suggested earlier, for a large part of the German readership, which had already previously encountered Foucault mainly in the more specialized circles of literary studies and historiography, but now had access to a rapidly expanding body of translations, it had created a stage and a scene upon which Foucault, the translated author, could appear. He became visible and readable, attractive or repellent, an opponent or a promising ally on this stage. And this is precisely what happened. The Habermasian framework was disseminated throughout international discussion, not least through the work of Habermas' American colleagues and readers following him. By 1985, when the book appeared, in which two large chapters attacked Foucault passionately, he himself had already died. Habermas had written a short but passionate obituary and had acknowledged his colleagues' achievements, but the stage was set, and in certain circles it remains remarkably powerful to this day. It is modernity versus post and anti-modernity. The accuracy of this framing, its strategic implications, and the systematic value of the readings Habermas proposed have, of course, been the object of an enormous body of philosophical literature, and this literature has produced an artifact, namely the Habermas-Foucault debate, which, of course, never occurred. Foucault did not know what Habermas was telling his Frankfurt students about him in the years that followed. There was no debate, and as I said, Foucault didn't even attend the lecture. But it had been, and it was, constructed, and it became a guiding phantasm for years to come, generating fully-fledged camps and lines of conflict and shaping on multiple sides the terms of philosophical debates for decades, not only in Germany, but also in varying degrees in many international contexts. And Didier can tell you all about this, of course, for the American case. Yet, within these debates, the names Habermas and Foucault, taken to be engaged in debate with one another, gradually acquired a new meaning and function. They referred less to the real authors and their non-communication than to the opposing sides of this presumed and perhaps even phantasmatic conflict. Their names became ciphers for positions, or symbols, emblems, for forms of positioning themselves, pro or contra modernity, pro or contra enlightenment. We could talk about this, and we could talk about who was right. I will not engage in this game today. My sense is that this has run its course and should now be treated primarily as a historical document. So let me take a different route. Let me propose the following. This debate is a discourse in the full technical Foucauldian sense, with its own rules and operations, in which the figure whom we call Habermas and the figure whom we call Foucault appear and perform specific functions. On this level, it becomes interesting to ask, what was the thing, the epistemic object that Habermas, or the figure whom we call Habermas, was seeking to defend, and that he perceived Foucault, or the figure whom we call Foucault, to be attacking, subverting, or delegitimizing? And what does it mean to attempt to settle this issue philosophically? Alternatively, we might ask, what is the question to which this debate constituted an answer, however paradoxical that answer may be? Let me offer a tentative suggestion. The object introduced by Habermas, not by Foucault, is broadly speaking modernity. A term, as you know, that Foucault rarely, almost never uses. But this is what the debate is about. Modernity, modern consciousness, modern values and achievements, modernization, we might say, the progress of science and individual freedom, a project of autonomy, as Castoriadis has called it. Against this positive and affirmative element, a negative counterpart is posited through a process of contrast and counterpositioning, the denial or subversion of this project, the assertion that it is in reality nothing but a project of control, a project of heteronomy. This counterpositioning, of course, is not without foundation. Recall Foucault's argument in Discipline and Punish that the humanitarian discourses demanding the humanization of punishment were themselves part of the emergence of a far more effective, fine-grained, and all-encompassing system of discipline and control. Or recall his ironic discovery in The Will to Knowledge that the search for the true self and the demand for the liberation of a supposedly natural sexuality from power were themselves strategies through which power binds individuals to identities in order to subject them more effectively. The discursive unfolding of position and counterposition is seductive, perhaps even slightly manipulative. If you say this, Habermas seems to suggest, then you, Foucault, are definitely denying that liberation, emancipation, or progress generally exist. And if power rather than reason is the principal motor of the social evolution that culminates in modern institution, then reason itself appears to be nothing more than a superficial ideological layer concealing underlying relations of power. Along these lines, Habermas would later argue in the book that Foucault fails to ground his own genealogical critique of modern institutions in any explicit normative orientation or justification. More fundamentally, he accuses him of being unable to account for the epistemic status of his own critique. The result, according to Habermas, is an aporetic, paradoxical, and ultimately powerless form of critique, one that undermines its own authority and its own claim to truth. This seems, I have to say, looking back, like a game that cannot be won, or rather one that is already won in advance by the Habermasians. For on its own terms, success can only be achieved within the framework of a normative theory of modernity and a normative conception of rational critique that produces or at least articulates the norm emerging from modernity itself. This debate, unreal yet highly generative in its reception, is indeed unsolvable. It consists precisely in this process of counterpositioning or oppositioning, which ultimately produces Habermas on the one side, Foucault on the other side. This discourse generates an impasse, a cul-de-sac, you might say, or rather two impasses, a dilemma, two paths leading nowhere and not crossing any more. It leaves two authors asserting their truth against the incompatible truth of the other, as if the intellectual space of 1983, or the intellectual space of the Collège de France itself, contained room for only one of them, as if this contemporaneity could not be shared, as if this moment could not be lived together. Part four, truth in constellation. I do think it is legitimate to ask who won, who was right. And as I said, I do not take Habermas, Foucault here as proper names or proper authors, but as elements within a discourse. I take their constellation, their relation, Habermas versus Foucault, to be a symptom of a real problem, of a genuine conundrum, however aporetic and antagonistic the discourse may make it appear. Let me try to explain what I mean by this. A Foucauldian perspective on this discourse would ask, what makes it possible? What are its conditions of existence? This means asking what kind of problem or problematic emerges in their constellation or in the discursive formation that binds these two names together, even as an antagonistic pair. In other words, the truth of the discourse does not reside in either of the positions taken separately, but in the aporetic or paradoxical constellation of the two positions, or the two names, itself. To put it differently, the truth, if there is any, of the Foucault-Habermas debate, inaugurated by a series of lectures given here, lies in the confrontation and the mutual provocation of two irreconcilable assertions, namely A, modernity in its own right and in its claim to authority must be defended, Habermas. B, the very terms through which modernity understands itself must be historicized, problematized, and deconstructed. Or, in another formulation, modernity or modernization as a process is the at least partially successful self-realization of reason or the continual realization of self-reflection against domination, Habermas, or versus modernity or modernization as a process is the continual extension of the means and scope of social domination in ever-shifting forms. Or more simply, the contrast is modernity in fulfilling the promise of the Enlightenment is a project of autonomy versus modernity only seemingly fulfilling the promise of the Enlightenment is a project of control or of biopower or of subjectivation. What does it mean now to treat these opposing assertions and the attached names as part of a discourse and as part of a constellation containing truth? It means that the truth of this debate might lie in seeing these assertions as irreconcilable and as simultaneous discursive events in their own right. Or, to put it more simply, the truth of this debate lies in the emerging insight that both sides are in the right, that both claims are, paradoxically speaking, true, even if they are contradictory. So we have three truths here. First, yes, modernity, as Habermas says, is a project of autonomy. But yes, as Foucault says, modernity is a project of control. And yes, this is a contradiction. The first is true because modernity is, in fact, the age of democracy, human rights, the liberating and empowering use of scientific rationality, and the implementation of non-coercive social structures, and the liberation of human creativity and productivity. The second is true because modernity is also the massive capture of individual life by systematic functional imperatives like capital, the pervasive infiltration of all spheres of human life by forms of power and administration, and the disempowering individualization and isolation of modern personal existence. And I personally would credit Jürgen Habermas, the real person, for seeing this challenge, for seeing that if Foucault is right, or what he thought Foucault means, this is an enormous challenge, even the destruction of modern self-consciousness and self-understanding. But the third truth implies that the first and the second truths, while contradictory, should be held together simultaneously, indeed at the same time. It is a truth about modernity as a project of autonomy and control that it is self-contradictory, paradoxical, or apparatic. Yes, this is what I'm claiming. Three truths, and the third one not even reconciling the contradictory nature of the first two. So no Aufhebung. This is nothing that has been settled or solved, neither by this debate nor by any other philosophy of the 1980s. Rather, I think this remains the ongoing task, the Aufgabe, and the unfinished project of a self-critical, self-reflexive philosophy, inheriting the Enlightenment without being duped by it. And this is definitely something I claim both theorists in question were trying to do at the time, but that's another story altogether having to do with two ways of inheriting the Enlightenment. Let me add one more remark here, which I hope is not too heretical, that once again betrays my own positionality and context. Within the context and tradition of critical theory and the Frankfurt School sense, the apparatic and paradoxical nature of modernity has a name, a proper name, and this name is the dialectic of Enlightenment. Not the book of Adorno and Horkheimer, but the theme, the thing that the Enlightenment has run into a dialectic, has produced its own opposite, and is being crushed by this inversion or perversion of reason and Enlightenment. So what I am indeed proposing here is that the constellation, the confrontation of Foucault and Habermas, which was not a debate but a discursive construction, is an instance, an emblem, an embodiment of the dialectical structure of Enlightenment or reason, which means it points to the inextricable intertwinement of autonomy and control, of emancipation and subjection, of freedom and domination. And the constellation, the non-debate Foucault-Habermas, can help us see this structure, help us recognize it, acknowledge it, and think it through ourselves. My last part, five, thinking the present. I have been discussing a highly specific moment in the reception of Foucault's work, tied to a very specific, the German context. What does this mean for us today, commemorating his achievements and legacy, and asking ourselves what it might mean to remain faithful to this legacy? As I said, I do not think that the real Foucault, whatever that might be, is present in the Habermas-Foucault debate. But I do think that the Habermas-Foucault constellation touches upon a real problem and a genuine philosophical task, namely thinking the paradoxical nature of modernity and a fortiori of Enlightenment and reason. This task is not to be solved and has not been solved, and Foucault has not solved it for us. It appears in different versions and different historical constellations, each present having to find its own specific response. But this is, after all, what it might mean for truth to be a thing from this world, as he said, namely, utterly historical and specific. So where then do we, contemporaries, encounter this dialectical, tragic, and apparatic structure of the modern age? Let me simply name three of its most pressing instances, and they will recur in the course of this conference for sure. none of which was absent from Foucault's horizon, but none of which was possessed the urgency that it has for us today. So first, out of three, and then I'm finished. First, we are witnessing the simultaneity of the most advanced technological means and possibilities and the largely uncontrolled, seemingly unmasterable destruction of the Earth through them. Already in the 1970s, one could have known that technological industrial modernization had brought about enormous material and civilizational progress, while at the same time creating the conditions for the most catastrophic self-destruction imaginable. The ecological crisis that we all, Foucaultians or not, deny with all our psychological might is our most drastic experience of the dialectic of modernity turning against and on itself. Second, our generation has come to accept, to recognize, and to admit that the inherent underside or shadow of the progress and wealth of the Western world is the demise of its non-Western other, that its progress, its humanity, is built on the blood and labor of those it did not deem fully human, those whom it dehumanized in order to exploit and abject. The philosophical afterlife of colonialism, also bizarrely absent from Foucault's work, as all of you know, and Stoller will talk about this again, of course, that has never properly ended, is a version of the wound of Western modernity itself. And third, our generation has once again come to experience the advent, a ghostly, uncanny return of totalitarianism, even fascism, not at the margins, but at the centers of Western societies. Not as an aberration, a deviation from the supposed path of democratization, but as one possibility within its space, however perverse, an inversion of the democratic within democracy. The political emancipation from heteronomy therefore produced an inversion of autonomy that turns against the modern subject of politics, the people itself. So the ecological crisis, the postcolonial afterlife, and the advent of neo-fascism are our versions, our experiences of exactly that kind of aporadic dialectical structure I'm trying to carve out of that debate. In that sense, the 1983-84 non-debate was preparing us to think our presence. Because none of these developments began after 1983, after Foucault's death, after he left us his toolbox. On none of these issues did he provide definitive perspectives, let alone solutions. But if the reading I have offered of the Habermas-Foucault constellation is convincing, or even minimally plausible, then he, or the figure whom we call Foucault, inhabited a theoretical space in which these paradoxes and aporias became at least thinkable, something to be accepted as a problem to be thought. And thinking the open wound of modernity is not easy, of course, but if this is true, that he was trying to achieve something like this, there is something, some hope that following him, not to the letter, but in spirit, can help us, contemporaries, to make sense of this predicament, which is the predicament of the modern, which is the condition of the present, which is our condition. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.